6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. You know, I want to go right to our guest because he's a very special person that we've had on this particular program several times already. And I really want to get to the thoughts. Listen to the words of Christopher Hedges talking about the Occupy movement. What we are witnessing in parks and squares across the United States is not simply the widespread revulsion over the greed and cruelty of corporate capitalism, but the articulation of a new and potent radicalism. This radicalism challenges the right of corporations to poison our ecosystem and turn greed and self-promotion into the highest good at the expense of human life. If this movement can cross class lines, if it can articulate its vision to those in marginalized communities, especially poor people of color, it can tap into a force and power that was never part of the new left. It can make possible the shaking of the foundations and, let us hope, the toppling of the corporate state. Christopher Hedges, for those of you who may not be familiar, is a journalist and public intellectual, and importantly, significantly now, not just a public intellectual, but an activist intellectual. Has a long history, numerous books. Many of you are familiar with him. His recent work, aside from fantastic, really, columns on Truth Dig, the recent book Death of a Liberal Class, in which we have a number of, four people pledging this hour, Death of a Liberal Class, his award-winning War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and most recently, a collection of essays, Truth Dig reprints, republication of Truth Dig columns over the recent years, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Chris Hedges, it's once again my pleasure and an honor to have you back at WORT. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chris, let's go right in, jump right into the Occupy Wall Street movement. I know you've been down there. You've witnessed it for yourself. I've seen you on YouTube, and you've written about it in the broader movement in a number of columns now. Let's start with a broader assessment. You've been energized. I was very touched by a YouTube interview I saw just late last night where you talked about how moving it has been for you and what this new movement represents.
Well, it's the last best hope. The fact is we don't have much time left just in terms of the environmental degradation that's being carried out by the corporate state. We stood by passively and watched as the Kyoto Accords, which were tepid and hardly enough, were shredded in Kyoto. There's been no check on the reconfiguration, not only within the nation, but in the global economy into a frightening kind of neo-feudalism and essentially the unleashing of unregulated, unchecked capitalism, which as Karl Marx understood as a revolutionary force that has the capacity now to turn everything into a commodity. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that these corporations can exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And this is really a cry of sanity, a recognition that if the corporate coup d'etat is not reversed, we're finished. And I think for those of us who were challenging the corporate state before this movement, whether it was Bill McKibben or myself or Ralph Nader or others, there was a kind of despair because these corporations were clearly driving us towards self-annihilation, quite literally. And yet the populace remained relatively passive and complacent. And I think the rise of this movement is monumental because it articulates a fundamental truth about our country and about corporate power, and it understands that unless power is returned to the consent of the governed, then there will be no ability to thwart the disastrous effects of corporate commodification of everything.
Chris Hedges, how do you explain that break from that passivity, that doldrums, that kind of pessimism by people observing and articulating the mood and the really the hegemony of the corporate mindset suddenly here in the States and elsewhere, taking many various shapes and forms? There's been a jarring of that passivity, a coming into motion of masses of people. How do you explain that? What brought
it
on?
Well, part of it is that these corporations know no limits. The only word they know is more. There's a term for it in business. It's called harvesting. They recognize that we don't make anything, that our financial system is run by speculators. And remember, speculation in the 17th century was a crime. Speculators were hung or hanged. And so they're going after every last bit of money they can funnel into their greedy little hands, whether it's education through charter schools, whether it's Social Security. There's just nothing that they won't steal, and there is no impediment to stop them. And I think that many of us felt that there would inevitably be a backlash. We didn't know what shape that backlash was going to take, and our fear was that the backlash would be articulated by these proto-fascist movements like the Tea Party, which are bankrolled by the most retrograde elements in American society, the Koch brothers and others, and attention is deflected away from Wall Street, where it should be directed, towards government, because these corporations want government to be even more anemic. It speaks in the language of the gun culture. It fuses the iconography and slogans of American nationalism with the Christian religion. It targets the vulnerable, the easy scapegoats, whether it's Muslims or undocumented workers or homosexuals or intellectuals. Very disturbing undercurrents of racism. It's coded, but, you know, they'll make war on Black History Month, for instance, that kind of stuff. And the whole birther movement is, of course, really an attempt to delegitimize Obama as, quote-unquote, the other. So the rise of this movement is a counterweight to a movement that really, in many of its tenets, can be described as fascist. And that's, of course, what happens when societies break down. And I spend a lot of time talking about this in my book, Death of the Liberal Class. But it's, in essence, what we have undergone with this kind of corporate coup is a destruction of radical movements, populist movements, which, of course, were always the true correctives to American democracy, whether it was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, coupled with a disemboweling of liberal institutions themselves in the name of anti-communism, so that there were no impediments left. And the corporate state, in its idiocy, decided that it could dispense with liberal institutions and the liberal class, whose function is not only to give a kind of patina of virtue to the state, but also, more importantly, to act as a kind of safety valve, to make incremental and piecemeal reform possible. And there is no way to make incremental or piecemeal reform possible. All of our legislation is written by corporate lobbyists, and of course that's why Obamacare is such a disaster. 2,000 pages written by the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, which ends up being the equivalent of the bank bailout bill, $400 billion in subsidies to these industries, the FISA Reform Act. I mean, the list just doesn't stop. And so when the vast majority, the 99%, are in essence locked out of the power elite, when their rights are ignored, when grievances can no longer be addressed by the formal structures of power, in essence when they don't count, then you inevitably build movements. What do those movements look like? Well, they often look like the Tea Party. I think part of what has been so moving about the Occupy Wall Street is, and these occupations everywhere now, is that they are politically, and I think even morally, so astute. They recognize that they have to remain nonviolent. They bend over backwards to be inclusive. I mean, in New York, when people speak, when you're online to speak, people whose voices have been traditionally marginalized within a society are given preference over, of course, white males. There is a steady recognition that that the issue is the corporate coup d'etat, and that we can make demands. I mean, we can call for electoral reform, we can call for revoking corporate personhood, but it's meaningless if there aren't mechanisms within the system, and there are, of course, not, to make these reforms possible.
Chris Hedges,
and it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen until our corporate overlords are removed from power, because the sort of simple fact is that it is impossible to vote in this country against the interests of Goldman Sachs.
Chris Hedges, you in your writing and several times already, as you were speaking just now, referred to this corporate coup d'etat. What do you mean by that? That is, it could be taken as a kind of, you know, there's a lot of conspiracism out there, a kind of analysis that becomes easy, it becomes facile. It's not an understanding of the structural and institutional nature of this corporate class and its domination, but tends to look at things in terms of cabals. What do you mean by the corporate coup d'etat?
Well, Sheldon Wolin lays this out probably as well as anyone in his book, Democracy Incorporated. Wolin probably being our greatest living political philosopher, taught many years at Berkeley and later at Princeton. And he calls the system that we live under inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means that it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in a classical totalitarian regime, you have a system whereby economic needs are subordinated to political needs. In inverted totalitarianism, it's the reverse. These anonymous corporate forces, which purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the language and symbols of American patriotism, in fact, have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And I think Wolin's right, that we have steadily seen all mechanisms by which the voices of the citizenry are heard and heeded, along with all regulations that once prohibited a class of speculators to seize control of the economy and the political process lifted. This began, of course, with Alan Greenspan under the Reagan administration, but was carried forth as assiduously by Democrats as by Republicans. It was Bill Clinton who passed NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the Taft-Hartley Act, who ripped down the firewalls between our commercial and investment banks and turned them over to hedge fund managers, which precipitated the crisis we're in, that refused to regulate derivatives trading, that gutted welfare. You know, by the time of the Clinton administration, what citizens needed, deserved, was no longer relevant. And, of course, the payoff was that the Democrats, by the 90s, had fundraising parity with the Republican Party in terms of corporate donations, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, he got more. And the latest figures show that Obama has gotten more corporate donations than all of the other Republican candidates combined.
Chris Hedges, you've waxed poetic on the optimistic and positive side in your appraisal of the Occupy movement, but you've also brought forward an important critique about the class composition and the racial class composition of the movement. Talk about that and why it is so vitally important, as I read in the opening quote, so vitally important for this movement to predominantly white and middle class, in quotes, to move beyond those confines and to broaden it out.
Well, this isn't the fault of the movement, but the liberal, white liberal class ignored for decades the steady impoverishment and draconian forms of police and security control, including, of course, the vast prison system that now holds 25% of the industrialized world's prison population, 60% of whom are people of color, of course. Bank repossessions, poverty, police brutality, none of these things were new in marginalized communities. It's something that people of color were experiencing and attempting to protest against for decades, and where was the white liberal class busying itself with the self-referential boutique activism of multiculturalism and identity politics and forgetting the core issue of justice? And so there's a great deal of understandable distrust in the part of these marginal communities about the movement. Their feeling is, and I think correctly, you protest, you sons and daughters of the white middle class, when it affects you, where were you when we were undergoing exactly the same process? And I think the movement, certainly in New York, I can speak for, is making a concerted attempt to reach out to those communities. Many of the Occupy Wall Street protesters joined Dr. Cornel West in Harlem when he was arrested protesting stop and frisk. I think this is exactly right. The power of this movement is that it is not confined to a particular class or group, unlike the New Left in the 60s, which was really a white middle-class phenomenon that had very little support from labor. Labor, in fact, was largely antagonistic, not only to the anti-war movement, but to the civil rights movement. Indeed, the FL-CIO supported Nixon's war in Indochina in the name of anti-communism. So I think that what we're seeing now is something very different and potentially far more powerful. When you have Teamsters, as they did when they threatened to throw them out of Zuccotti Park to ostensibly clean it, show up to help protect the park, it is an indication that this movement reaches into sectors of the population that traditional leftist movements have not been able to reach since the turn of the century, when we had figures like Mother Jones and Eugene Debs and Big Bill Haywood and the Wobblies who married that progressive, populist, radical politics with the interests of labor. That's something that's we certainly did not see in the 60s. Maybe the last time we caught a glimpse of it was in the 1930s, but even then, of course, the severe repression, especially of the Communist Party and people who were deemed to be soft on communism. It's how Henry Wallace's 1948 presidential campaign was sabotaged. Has meant that American society, especially the underclass, has effectively been divided against itself, and hopefully that will be overcome by these movements.
I'm looking through the window, and Nigel, our engineer, our weekly engineer, tells us that we have a guest that has a question or a comment for Chris Hedges. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, Alan. On Democracy Now!, I believe it was last Thursday, William S. Black said that he had just 15 minutes before airtime had posted a story about Bank of America taking up $75 trillion worth of junk derivatives from their affiliate, Merrill Lynch. And since then, I have heard that the entire gross domestic product of the world is between $58 and $60 trillion. This is a story I think should be disseminated because this is the stuff of which global economic collapse is made. And I just wondered if you're aware of it, if you can speak about it and disseminate this information. It's extremely critical. In fact, I think it is the main news story today.
Chris Hedges, the generalized theft of Bank America?
Well, they're hardly alone. I mean, it's theft sort of in all quarters. I mean, every time these speculators would inflate a bubble, whether it was the tech bubble or the savings and loan bubble or the housing bubble, jack up prices of products or stocks or houses or whatever far beyond their actual value, make a killing off of it, and then it would collapse. You had the Federal Reserve rushing to give them more money to begin all over again, which is precisely what's happened. And they've already evaporated $40 trillion of worldwide wealth, $17 trillion of domestic wealth, and most of that is money that people had put into pension plans and 401ks and savings accounts, mutual funds, completely destroyed, completely taken from them. So Bank of America is a criminal enterprise in the same way that Goldman Sachs or Citibank is, but I think more importantly extends into the Treasury Department and the Fed itself, which aid and abet this behavior at our expense. So international finance is complicated, and it's meant to be abstruse and difficult to understand. It's how they cook up CDOs and all sorts of other anachronistic terms that none of us can quite figure out. But the bottom line is that it's theft on a massive scale, probably unseen in human history.
You know, Chris Hedges, you talk about, in regard to all of this, whether it be the state or these corporate giants, these financial institutions, that there's no way to appeal to the system, that there is no way to vote against your line, no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. You've written at length about the hollowing out, the emptiness, the hopelessness of the mainstream parties, especially the Democratic Party. Where can we take it?
Well, it's exactly where the occupation movements have taken it, which is civil disobedience. And the great mistake in Wisconsin was that very positive energy got funneled right back into the system in terms of a recall effort, courtesy of the Democratic Party and the labor unions. And where they should have gone is a general strike. And I think that nobody's sitting around in these Occupy movements appealing to this system because they recognize that it's a fruitless and useless endeavor. And I think that it's the harsh reality of where we live. But once we confront that political reality, it's empowering in the sense that we can begin to respond rationally and sanely to these forces rather than be directed as these repugnant faux liberal groups like MoveOn.org do back into a system that will never respond.
You've written in numerous places and referenced it just now, your critique of MoveOn.org and other basically Democratic Party creations to co-opt not only this movement, they had their rise in the anti-war movement, and then when Obama started to run, they stopped talking about the wars. Talk about what's the basis of your critique of MoveOn?
Well, MoveOn, I think, finally exposed who they were during the whole healthcare debate, when it became clear that the Obama White House never had any intention of including the public option. And the Obama White House permitted corporate lobbyists to write the bill. MoveOn's response, they couldn't defend the bill anymore because it was just another corporate rape of the American citizenry. Indeed, in essence, passing laws by which we as citizens will be forced to buy their defective product. And so they said, well, we have to pass it because it's a referendum on the Obama presidency. I'm very angry at these groups because I think that they seduce a lot of well-meaning people into their embrace and into the embrace of the Democratic Party, and in fact are just terribly disempowering.
And of course now, we have this, you know, this, we're going into the election cycle, and already lots of people are saying, well, look at the alternatives, and you got to vote, we got to get Obama back. I hear it already here in various sectors in Madison, and of course there's the motion to recall Walker here. But the election, that election cycle, I don't think it's going to be like the previous one when they sold hope and change and people got chump change.
Well, that's the tragedy. I mean, I think people actually did want. I mean, I think the desires for change were quite genuine. And, you know, these people are very sophisticated. They do focus group and poll after poll, and they understand very well what we want. And then they repeat it back to us with no intention of ever delivering. And that's how Obama wins the election and then wins Advertising Age's top annual award, which is Marketer of the Year, because the professionals understood precisely what he had accomplished. Look, the reason we have the rise of a lunatic fringe within the political establishment is precisely because the liberal mechanisms by which reform were once made possible no longer work. And the longer we continue to empower politicians like Barack Obama, the more certain we will become, as the society disintegrates, of ending up with a horrible figure like Rick Perry or someone else. That, you know, I was very involved in 2008 in the Nader campaign. I wrote several of Ralph's major policy speeches, and our understanding and our belief was that we need to pull 5, 10, 15 million Americans who hold fast to the moral imperatives that the Occupy movements hold in order to fight back, to put pressure on these corporate forces. Unfortunately, that didn't happen in 2008. Of course, you know, is Barack Obama better than Mitt Romney? Of course. But I think that supporting the Democratic Party, which is just as subservient to Wall Street, and just as captive to the military-industrial complex, and just as incapable of restoring basic civil liberties, including habeas corpus, is a tactic that we have to face has not worked. It will not halt the neo-feudalistic reconfiguration of America. It will not halt or diminish in any way corporate power. It will not blunt our imperial expansion, which is hollowing the country out from the inside. On all of the major structural issues, there is no difference between George W. Bush and Barack Obama.
Chris Hedges, let's go to the phone line. I see we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if Mr. Hedges has given any thought to the degree to which wealth and military power, violence, is needed to change the corporate myth, because the corporations will undoubtedly buy not only police departments, they have now bought the Pentagon. How much violence is going to be needed in order to change the system? And does that necessarily corrupt whatever system replaces it? Could you comment, please?
Well, the corporate state desperately wants these protests to speak in the language of violence, because that's not only a language they understand, it's a language they know how to master. They want pictures of protesters smashing windows and overturning cop cars. That's exactly what they have tried to provoke, certainly at the inception of the Occupy Wall Street movement. These were attempts by the police to get a response. They didn't get a response. And I think that, you know, so far we haven't gone down that road. I know that there were some excesses in Oakland, but generally this movement has remained nonviolent, and I think it has to remain nonviolent, partly because when corrupt regimes come down, you want to create a situation where the foot soldiers that enforce control, i.e. the police, don't respond. I mean, this is what happened. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. This is what happened. The East German police and the Czech police finally, as the power elite was increasingly discredited and crowds of 500,000 people were assembling in Alexanderplatz or in Wenceslas Square in Prague, the police wouldn't do the bidding of the overlords. And in New York, there has been a very careful and concerted attempt to not only not be antagonistic to the blue uniform police, but also to be respectful. And I think that's very, very smart. It's something that I saw in East Germany, and I saw in Prague, and it works. What you want now is to build such massive numbers that the narrow oligarchic corporate elite is exposed for who they are, and you want to keep it nonviolent, and you want essentially to entice at the lowest level the enforcers of control onto your side, and I think that that's probably the smartest tactic.
You know, Chris Hedges, it's interesting because here it was observable in February and March. What was needed, as you alluded to here, was the mass civil disobedience of a general strike. But yet there was lots of confusion about the, in some ways I would argue, confusion about the police, and many of us argued that if it moved from the level of request for redress, protest movement, and moved to the level of direct action of nonviolent civil disobedience, that the character of the police would shift. People were arguing here that the police are on our side, that you know, and it was made more complex even by the fact that there were cops for labor in the crowds, and that people lost the distinction between the state troopers who locked everyone out that enforced the lockout of the state capitol, so it's very complex. I watched the footage and live feeds from Oakland, and the cops there just let loose with the barrage, and it becomes a tough situation.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
we're gonna see scenes like Oakland.
And no, I agree with you that this kind of mass movement is the way to go, especially because of the militarization of the policing here in the U.S. The cops
as
RoboCop.
But look at the response to Oakland. I mean, especially with this grievously wounded vet.
From Wisconsin, by the way.
What's that?
From Wisconsin, and
wearing
a Vets for Peace T-shirt when he was.
Wisconsin, but I mean, look at this. This will backfire.
They had six
on the authorities in the same way that the pepper spraying of those women by Inspector Anthony Bologna backfired on the New York City Police Department, and the difference in the behavior of the New York City Police Department before and after that pepper spray incident is quite dramatic. They really had to back off, and of course they literally had to back off when they threatened to shut down the park to clean it and thousands of people linked arms, including Teamsters, and said, we're not going. So there's no question that as the power elite, which is clearly terrified, becomes more and more isolated, they will attempt to use harsher forms of control. But I'm not sure it's going to work. And I think that the images that have now been disseminated throughout the country out of Oakland, given the broad support that this movement has, is one that's only going to inflame people
further.
I think it's a completely counterproductive tactic on the part of the corporate state.
I noticed last night in response to the attack by the police on the Oakland Occupy site the day before, that last night there was an estimated 6,000 people who reoccupied the site. It was very, just the photographs of it are quite remarkable. You know, I got a feeling only because we haven't had a number of our regular callers that people are at the solidarity demonstration in solidarity with Occupy Oakland and that Wisconsin comrade who was injured by a police canister, you know, hit in the head, critical condition. You know, there was calls for that rally at noon. We're into the last 10 minutes. Chris Hedges, you've talked about, you've referenced populism and the populist nature of this movement, but you've also talked about the various strands here and elsewhere. You've talked about the various strands within populism. There is a right-wing populism. It's an astroturf, presently a kind of populist anger that is surfacing on the right. And in that context, you've talked about a creeping fascism in America. That potential, talk about that.
Well, unfortunately, when you have dysfunctional systems, you give rise to movements that articulate that rage in very pernicious and negative ways, and I think the Tea Party militia movements are examples of that. Up until now, we've not really had a counterweight to those movements. And my hope is that this will steer opposition into a direction that doesn't replicate the racism, the intolerance, the embrace of violence that one sees at Tea Party rallies. But always, I mean, you go back to the 1930s and Father Coughlin and, you know, Henry Ford and others. I mean, fascism has a powerful appeal, especially for industrialists and capitalists who feel threatened, which is why you have the kind of money being pumped into the Tea Party by the Koch brothers and other corporate capitalists, because they see it as a populist vehicle by which they can protect themselves.
Chris Hedges, I was very moved watching a YouTube video interview you did from Occupy Wall Street this past week or so about the hope. And I was moved by a line you came out with, a very, you know, and I think the same things when, for instance, I'm hanging out with my great nephew, that both of us and numbers of our listeners, we're not getting younger, and we're not in this movement for social change and for restoring a progressive hope for ourselves, but for our children. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I've got four kids. It's not about me anymore. It's about them. And I think we have to ask what kind of a world we're going to leave them. Not only in terms of this new global serfdom where you have a rapacious oligarchic corporate elite, a thin managerial class, and workers who, in places like southern China, I suppose can't even be considered workers because they often don't even get wages at the end of the month, which is why you'll always get some climbing to the tops of these factories and jumping off, committing suicide. Where the American worker is just told over and over they have to be competitive on the global marketplace. But what they're really being told is that they have to be competitive with prison labor or workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour so you can buy your shirts at Gap. So, yeah, it's not about me. It's about them. And that's why I find the movement so moving, because its success will mean that they have a future, and its failure will be catastrophic. I think, you know, without being overly dramatic, this is literally a fight for life.
Chris Hedges, think about a sign or a chant, an image that you were struck with that lifted you down and Occupy Wall Street. There were many, many marvelous signs and slogans during the mobilization here this past year. Something that enthused you, that gave you, renewed your hope?
Well, I don't know that there was a particular sign or slogan. I think the energy of the movement itself, the incredible ability to articulate not only our political reality, but what we must do to fight it, and the resiliency. I mean, I'm down at Zuccotti Park quite a bit, and I'm always just deeply moved. It's cold down there. Concrete's not a pleasant place to, you know, slabs of concrete are not comfortable. You know, people are sort of surviving on bread and pizza, and they won't go. And I think it's more the whole body of the movement itself that I find deeply empowering and moving.
Well, you know, we're getting down to the end of the hour. You have an optimism in this movement. It certainly is textured by your historical experience. You have a sense of where it may go?
Nobody knows where movements go. Nobody sitting in the Magic Lantern in Prague every night with Václav Havel could have predicted that within a matter of weeks the communist government in Czechoslovakia would fall. And the same was true in East Germany. Even those who are most closely associated with the movement don't know. I was with the leaders of the East German opposition movement on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989, and they said that perhaps within a year there'd be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, at least as an impediment to movement, the Berlin Wall didn't exist. Even they didn't know. No one knows.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to draw to a close, but I want to thank you ever so much for taking your time. You know, you're on with Charlie Rose. You've been, you know, you have a public face, and here you've given this relatively small station in Madison, Wisconsin, an hour of your time. Why is that important to you?
Well, because the corporate state has worked very hard to make sure that our systems of communication don't give voice to the legitimate concerns and struggles of ordinary people. And that's why the corporate airwaves are filled with the trash and trivia and garbage that they are. Stations like these are never going to get donations from Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil.
Well, we don't want them.
And so they become absolutely vital in terms of conveying a narrative that isn't built around fantasy or gossip, but built around the reality that most of us face day in and day out.
So Chris Hedges, I want to thank you again very, very much for being with us this hour, and I hope to speak with you soon. Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.